Live with the politics, current affairs and culture the nation's talking about. Back tomorrow from 4 p.m. now. Bye for now.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, no relief in sight for mortgage borrowers as the Reserve Bank leaves interest rates on hold. Also, thousands of people flee southern Lebanon as Israeli airstrikes continue. And can new technology stop endangered eagles flying into wind farm turbines?
Since that tower was installed last year, there's been no wedge-tailed eagle mortalities. It's really great to see a technology solution to address an environmental impact.
In a widely expected move, the Reserve Bank has left interest rates unchanged today at 4.35%. The RBA Governor, Michelle Bullock, says the economic outlook is still uncertain and she's not ruling hiking interest rates in the months to come, nor is she willing to give any hope a cut isn't too far away. Our business reporter David Taylor joins me now to decode all of this. David, so most of, if not all economists really, were expecting the RBA to keep rates unchanged today. But did the Governor, Michelle Bullock, have anything new to say this afternoon?
Good evening, Sam. Look, I think the last time the RBA met, the board spent time discussing an interest rate hike and many mortgage borrowers wouldn't like the sound of that. Today, though, the Governor, Michelle Bullock, said the board didn't, quote, explicitly discuss an interest rate hike. Now, what does that mean? Well, simply that so little has changed, the board, in terms of the data coming in on the economy, the board didn't feel it necessary to have an in-depth discussion about higher interest rates. But again, Sam, she has said that she's not ruling anything in or out. Now, that means, in plain speak, there is the potential for an RBA interest rate hike by the end of the year. There's also a potential for an interest rate cut before the end of the year. It all depends on the data. And just on that, it depends on inflation and jobs. I can't make it more simple than that. What the Reserve Bank wants to see is lower inflation without putting too many Australians out of work with elevated interest rates. So it's unclear what a cash rate of 4.35%, which it is now, will ultimately do to the economy. So I asked the Governor, Michelle Bullock, this afternoon, if she was confident Australia would not enter a recession. Here's what she said.
Our forecasts do not have it entering recession at the moment. But as I've said, if you look at the forecasts, there are very wide bands. The further out you go, the broader the bands of error. Certainly, we are aiming not to end up in recession. That's what we're aiming for. Could I guarantee it? No. You only have to look at the forecast errors to see I can't guarantee anything. But certainly that is what we are aiming at.
That's the Reserve Bank Governor, Michelle Bullock. And David, earlier this month, the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, showed his displeasure, I guess, with high interest rates, saying that they were smashing the economy. What has Dr. Chalmers had to say about the RBA decision today?
Yeah, and interesting as well, though, Sam, on that, Michelle Bullock indicated today in a fairly nuanced way that the economy actually wasn't being, quote, smashed by interest rates in its current setting at 4.35%. Now, the government is talking up the progress that it says it's made on reducing inflation. And the Treasurer Chalmers has basically said that two budget surpluses, spending restraint and energy rebates are all helping to reduce inflation. Here's the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers.
The government remains primarily focused on the fight against inflation, but is not ignoring those risks to growth at the same time. We have the same objective as the Reserve Bank when it comes to the fight against inflation. So we've made welcome and encouraging progress, and we'll learn more about that tomorrow when the monthly inflation data is released. Whether that monthly inflation data is in the low threes or the high twos, it will show that inflation has halved since we came to office. That's a good thing.
The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers. And David, what's the opposition had to say?
Well, this is where it gets really interesting. I'm going to introduce a sort of a little bit of a term, burnout economics. Now, this is what commentators are saying are currently happening to the economy. You've got the government, commentators say, with its foot on the accelerator. Jim Chalmers would obviously reject that. And the Reserve Bank trying to cut spending back. And it's producing this sort of foot on the accelerator, foot on the brake phenomenon that's kind of making the economy itself stall, as the Shadow Treasurer says. But the opposition is basically saying that the government is making the Reserve Bank's job harder with its policies. Here's the Shadow Treasurer, Angus Taylor.
The reality is this government has its foot on the accelerator at the same time as the Reserve Bank is trying to put the foot on the brake. And that stalls the engine. And that's exactly what we've seen. We've seen six consecutive quarters of negative GDP per capita growth, and still inflation is persistent. That's a result of a government that simply does not know how to beat its own homegrown inflation.
The Shadow Treasurer, Angus Taylor, and before him, our business reporter, David Taylor. Well, if the Reserve Bank's decision to leave rates on hold today has left you feeling down and worried, you're certainly not alone. The Committee for Economic Development of Australia, or CEDA, says Aussies are living through the longest period of economic misery since 2011. Economist Liam Dillon is the author of what CEDA calls its Misery Index.
So the Misery Index is a tool for understanding how much, misery or pressure most Australians are feeling at the moment. And it comprises of three key elements that most Australians will understand and resonate with. And that's the interest rates, which are set by the Reserve Bank of Australia, the rate of unemployment and the rate of inflation. And so while this time unemployment has been a real source of strength for the economy, historically that hasn't always been the case, and higher unemployment has led to higher levels of misery in previous downturns. But now what we see is that it's really that combination of higher inflation, which has been stubborn and persistent, combined with those higher interest rates that the RBA are using to really try and tackle and bring those inflation rates down to a sustainable level.
Do you think the Stage 3 tax cuts and the electricity bill rebates that we're getting are going to keep inflation up?
So what the Reserve Bank and we expect is that those cost of living supports, particularly those electricity rebates, will help bring headline inflation down. But those supports are temporary. And so the Reserve Bank is really focused on underlying inflation, which it thinks is a better measure of the momentum of inflation getting towards its target range. But certainly those cost of living supports are one of the factors that's contributing to uncertainty around the economic outlook. What we know so far is that fortunately those are appearing as though they're going more towards savings than spendings, which was helping in terms of not adding to inflationary pressures.
What's your reaction to the Reserve Bank's decision to keep rates on hold today?
Look, I think it's unsurprising, and the Reserve Bank needs to be commended in its laser focus on bringing inflation back down to target. As we show with this Misery Index, it's really that inflation piece which is bringing a lot of hardship to many members of our community right now. And that's why Michelle Bullock and the Reserve Bank are so intent on bringing it back to heel and to a sustainable level. And so their decision to keep it at what it called a restrictive level, I think, is unsurprising. And it's good to see that they have that focus on bringing inflation back to target.
There's been a lot of discussion, though, in recent months, given the pain people are feeling with these very high interest rates and the higher mortgage repayments, that perhaps keeping interest rates high isn't the best weapon. Do you think high interest rates are the only way to bring inflation down?
Look, I think that what this shows is that having a job at the Reserve Bank and Michelle Bullock's job is very difficult, because what we see from the Misery Index is the trade-off that the Reserve Bank has to make. So high inflation causes hardship for people in the community, but equally those higher interest rates add to pain as well. And the combination of those, as we say in our research, is miserable. But unfortunately, the Reserve Bank only has its one lever to pull on. It's pulling on it, and it needs to continue to do so to make sure that inflation gets back to target, because it really is something that hurts everyone in our community, and it's in everyone's interest to get that back to target as soon as possible.
on that very point, let's try and move away from misery. Can you give us some good news if possible? Do you think we'll see interest rates coming down soon?
Look, I think that what we can expect is that early next year at the earliest is when interest rates might have a possibility of coming down a little bit. I'd certainly welcome if it was earlier, but I think that that's probably the earliest stage. But one thing to point out is that the Australian economy, in particular our labour market, has been very robust despite the economic headwinds that we've had. And so, you know, while we compare ourselves to our international peers, we've done a really good job in holding off a sharp increase in unemployment. So in Australia, the rate of unemployment has increased by only 0.6 percentage points, but compared to the US, that's increased by 0.8 percentage points, and it's gone up by 1.6 percentage points in Canada. On top of that, we have a really strong participation rate. So more people are in a job, that helps them to weather these hard economic times. And I think that's something we can all be happy about.
Liam Dillon is an economist at CEDA, the Committee for Economic Development of Australia. To southern Lebanon now, where an estimated 500 people have been killed in Israeli airstrikes targeting Hezbollah operations, and that was just over the last day. More than 1,600 people have been injured. Women and children are among the dead. But the Israeli military says, quote, large numbers of Hezbollah terrorists have been killed. Thousands of people are fleeing the region. Kathleen Ferguson prepared this report.
Cranes sift through the rubble in a Beirut street that's been hit by airstrikes. Australian-born photographer Renato Obeid has lived in Lebanon since 1991.
Beirut is a small place, so we're all afflicted by this. For example, we've been hearing the sonic booms, and we've been seeing the Israeli jets flying over on a almost daily basis. It's a constant wailing of sirens, and also now an exodus from Beirut, from the southern suburbs, working its way through East Beirut and going all the way here to the north. Bumper-to-bumper traffic, people just panicking, basically.
He says it's hard to come to terms with what they are experiencing.
I guess it's shock and awe, because on top of all of the afflictions we've had in this country in recent years, ranging from the port explosion to economic collapse. So it's one of shock and awe.
Israel launched hundreds of airstrikes in southern and eastern Lebanon, saying it's trying to push the militant group Hezbollah from its northern border. Lebanese officials say more than 490 people have been killed, including 35 children and 58 women. It's the deadliest day of cross-border conflict since 2006. More than 1,600 people were also wounded. The European Union's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, says the fallout is unacceptable.
I continue condemning it. The civilians are paying a high price in almost a full-blown war, which must be averted.
Israel says it warned residents in Beirut to evacuate from the area before the strikes. Israeli army spokesperson Daniel Hagari says Hezbollah made the first move last year, immediately after another militant group, Hamas, launched its attack on October 7th.
Israel did not attack, Lebanon did not attack Hezbollah. It's Hezbollah on the 8th of October started firing on Israeli civilians in the northern border, and he's been doing this for over 11 months with 9,000 rockets, and 60,000 Israelis have left their homes. We have to act to stop the threat of Hezbollah.
Thousands in Lebanon are trying to flee affected parts, putting pressure on roads. The Australian government has been urging citizens who can leave to do so for some time. And the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, repeated that call today.
The numbers of Australians in Lebanon are beyond the capacity of the government to provide assistance to all. There are very large numbers of Australians in Lebanon.
But Jamel Keir from the Lebanese Muslim Association, based out of Sydney, says getting out isn't that simple.
We've begged the Australian government to... They've got to understand that it's all and well for them to say, get out of Lebanon. The question we want to ask is, how do they expect them to get out? You know, Lebanon geographically is surrounded by Syria, which is at war, and Israel to its south. And to its east, it's got the Mediterranean Ocean, which obviously it can't use because the Navy of Israel is guarding that.
He says many in Lebanon are seeking help.
In the last couple of days, we're getting calls nearly every minute at least. And we are predominantly in the north of Lebanon, our organisation. So our brothers and sisters in the south are even in more a dire strait than ourselves.
Australian-born man Renato Obeid is choosing to stay, despite admitting the advice to leave is sound.
The expats that do remain here are, I suppose, bitter enders, hardcore Lebanese, because everybody who had the inclination to leave has left in waves after every successive affliction.
But he says Lebanon can't keep taking blows.
The Lebanese people cannot handle this anymore. This is way beyond the famous Lebanese resilience.
Renato Obeid is an Australian living in Beirut. That report from Kathleen Ferguson and Isabel Rowe. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, Queensland farmers welcome the prospect of greater rewards for looking after the environment. Now to Victoria and the defamation case embroiling the state's Liberal leader, John Pesutto. He's being sued by a former Liberal MP who alleges Mr. Pesutto wrongly linked her with neo-Nazis. The case is exposing divisions between the Vic Liberals' conservative wing and the more progressive arm led by Mr. Pesutto. David Escort is following the case. First, David, remind us what this case is about.
Sam, former Liberal MP Maura Deeming is suing party leader John Pesutto for defamation. And this all started at this Let Women Speak rally, which is an anti-transgender rights event held outside of Victorian Parliament in March last year. Maura Deeming actually helped organise the rally, and the rally hosted this controversial anti-transgender activist named Kelly J. Keane Minshall. And at the event itself, there were a lot of protests. And then while that was all going on, it was gatecrashed by this really well-known neo-Nazi group here in Melbourne. So in the weeks and months after, Maura Deeming was then kicked out of the party for her involvement with the event. And it's in that process, she says, that John Pesutto actually linked her appearance at that rally to this group of neo-Nazi gatecrashers. And it's actually that allegation which she says is defamatory. These comments that he made following the rally, which she alleges linked her to the neo-Nazis. And now the case has become this battleground where it's really testing the leadership of the Liberal Party because of all of their internal business is now being aired in court and really showing the intense division inside of the Liberal Party itself.
And today, Mr. Pesutto was grilled in court by Barrister Sue Chrysantha, who's representing Maura Deeming. What was he asked about?
So Sue Chrysantha started out quizzing him about this concept of procedural fairness. She put to John Pesutto that he had used bad sources of information in this dossier that was put together to justify kicking Maura Deeming out of the party. And John Pesutto rejected that out of hand. Sue Chrysantha then went so far as to label the dossier itself so poor it's as if it was written by an 8-year-old. He was then also quizzed about the discovery of this infamous recording that was taken in the meeting where John Pesutto, alongside a few other senior members of the party, asked Maura Deeming to resign and told her that they would seek her expulsion from the party. It was this recording last week that became a major piece of evidence in the case. Today, John Pesutto was grilled over why Deputy Liberal Leader David Southwick, who made the recording, kept it secret from everybody for so long. John Pesutto told the court that while he was surprised about the existence of this recording, it was David Southwick that recorded it. And One other interesting aspect of the evidence today is that he was questioned about this notion of Liberal Party philosophy that they allow a lot of free speech in the party room. Sue Chrysanthou pressed him about this, actually getting John Pesutto to admit that he tolerates people with different views in the party, and this is where the tension with Moira Deeming comes in. And he said that even if someone associated with people that caused reputational damage to the party, it's actually not enough to expel them, and this is something that he agreed. And then there was this very interesting and confrontational exchange between John Pesutto and Sue Chrysanthou. She put to him that he was only elected leader by one vote. And at that moment, John Pesutto sort of snapped at her, saying, "So what? So what?" He actually repeated it twice, which was quite dramatic. Sue Chrysanthou also accused John Pesutto of failing to answer her questions instead of just giving what she described as these political speeches in court.
So, David, what happens next in this case?
So John Pesutto is going to have to continue giving evidence over the next few days, and the case returns to the Melbourne Federal Court tomorrow.
David Eastcourt reporting. Opponents of a wind farm proposed for Tasmania's Central Highlands are warning the project's turbines could kill endangered eagles. They want the development scrapped. One nearby wind farm in the same area, though, thinks it has a solution to the problem. It's using Australian First technology to shut down turbines to prevent eagles colliding with them. Alexandra Humphreys has more.
Tasmania's Central Highlands are sparsely populated, and renewable energy companies are eyeing it off for new wind farms. Victoria Onslow lives in the area. She's worried those plans could come at the expense of endangered birds.
Probably the greatest concern, or one of the greatest concerns, is the wedge-tailed eagles, the Tasmanian wedge-tailed eagle. They're an endangered species in Tasmania, and they're the biggest eagle in Australia.
Tasmanian wedge-tailed eagles are an endangered subspecies of the birds found on mainland Australia. It's estimated there are just 1,000 left in the wild, and many of them call the Central Highlands home. When they collide with wind turbines, it's fatal. Victoria Onslow, who's the secretary of the local organisation called the No Turbine Action Group, is concerned about plans for a new wind farm at St Patrick's Plains.
There are 17 wedge-tailed eagle nests on the site. So, I mean, any normal person or developer coming onto a place like that would take one look and just go, oh, no. This is critical habitat for these birds and they should be left undisturbed. But that unfortunately wasn't the case.
Information submitted to the Environment Protection Authority by the proponent estimated the wind farm could kill up to 81 eagles over 30 years of operations. Nick Mooney is an independent wildlife biologist.
The Central Highlands is a moderate to high density area. I mean, where you're building dangerous things like wind farms, it would seem common sense 101 to, if you're concerned about eagles, to put them where there are less eagles.
The nearby Cattle Hill wind farm confirmed 8 eagle deaths in its first few years of operations. With a second farm at St Patrick's Plains planned and others in the pipeline, Nick Mooney is worried about the cumulative impact.
Any one wind farm can kill a few eagles, but all put together, can become an overwhelming amount. But even one or two wind farms clumped together can create what we call a population sink, where more birds are killed than that area produces. And if you have enough population sinks scattered about, the whole population starts to decline.
At Cattle Hill Wind Farm, where wedge-tailed eagles were killed previously, Director John Titchen says things have turned around. The farm is using new technology called Identiflight to shut down turbines when eagles are detected.
The technology involves towers that have cameras on the top, and the cameras can scan for birds and can identify whether it's a wedge-tailed eagle, a white-bellied seagull, or another bird. And if the bird's heading towards a turbine and gets within a specified distance, then the turbine will be instructed to shut down.
After those 8 deaths in its first years of operation, the system has been tweaked and an extra tower added.
Since that tower was installed last year, there's been no wedge-tailed eagle, white-bellied seagull mortalities. The system is shutting down turbines. It is preventing impacts. So we're pretty confident it's making a real contribution.
It's technology that the planned St Patrick's Plains wind farm will also adopt. Donna Bolton is with Arc Energy, the company behind the project.
And we're very fortunate that we come second in that because they have done a lot of learning and we will be benefiting, I suppose, from all of the things that they have learned on their journey through. We anticipate that if there are any issues whatsoever that can't be addressed by Identiflight, then we have committed to looking at the Blackblade technology.
St Patrick's Plains Wind Farm has received its Tasmanian planning approvals, but that decision is being challenged by the No Turbine Action Group in the state's planning tribunal. Hearings are expected to begin next year.
Alexandra Humphreys reporting from Tassie. Farmers and conservationists in Queensland are optimistic that state government plans will make it easier for landholders to get what are known as carbon credits. Farmers can earn credits by improving their environmental management, and then investors and companies buy the credits to offset their pollution. The Queensland government has promised funding to educate farmers on how to enter those schemes, which are sometimes called nature markets. Annie Guest explains.
Around the world, people are increasingly demanding food that's been produced in an environmentally responsible way. Joe Shepherd is the CEO of the Queensland Farmers Federation.
We are now seeing opportunities in the natural capital space emerging. I think over the next sort of 3 to 5 years, we will see more defined opportunities coming forward.
So what is natural capital? It includes vegetation, soil, water and biodiversity such as koalas and other endangered species. It's all expected to be part of so-called nature markets that are emerging in the race to net zero. Former Treasury boss Dr. Ken Henry, who's now the head of the Australian Climate and Biodiversity Foundation, explains.
Australia is still at the very early stages of developing markets in both carbon and biodiversity. There is enormous opportunity, and Australia is seen globally as one of the places, one of the few places in the world where there is substantial opportunity to sequester carbon and to restore biodiversity.
The idea is that farmers who make environmental improvements will get a benefit. That's already possible with carbon credits and reef credits, and now there are biodiversity credits. The credits are worth money and can be sold to investors or companies who need to offset their pollution to comply with the law. In an election promise, the Queensland Treasurer Cameron Dick has pledged funding to help farmers get involved in those credit markets.
Well, it will mean it will make it easy for landholders, whoever they might be, including farmers, First Nations groups and others, to generate high-quality carbon credits and biodiversity credits, which are in global demand.
Landholders will be able to get support and advice from natural resource management groups. And that's welcome news to Joe Shepherd from the Farmers Federation.
So farmers will be able to access support to understand these emerging opportunities better. That's a really important factor. And there will be an investment into supporting farmers to do their baselining work, which is also a really important first step. You know, you'll be looking at obviously vegetation, but soil health, but the biodiversity on your place, so what species are living on your place.
From there, any project aimed at obtaining a credit would require approval from the National Clean Energy Regulator.
You know, whether it is a tree planting project or whether it's a soil health project, which have really delivered some really good environmental outcomes.
Australia has tens of thousands of farms, but only 1,700 are doing projects in exchange for carbon credits, valued at about $35 per tonne of abatement. Dr. Ken Henry forecasts farmers could increase their income by an average of 10%.
We should expect to see a carbon price maybe 10 years from now, at least double what Australia's carbon price is. That for many farms, that could be not just tens of thousands of dollars, but even hundreds of thousands of dollars a year.
It's something the Queensland government is so sure of that it's spending $90 million to buy more agricultural land for the same purpose through its state-owned Queensland Investment Corporation, or QIC. The corporation already owns a sugarcane farm and a cattle station, and it's the majority owner in another major pastoral operation. Its CEO is Kylie Ramper.
We are trialling new soil organic carbon initiatives at scale, wildlife corridors at scale, improving water runoff into the Great Barrier Reef catchment. And we feel that there will be very strong interest from the investors we deal with around the globe to invest and have impact investing into natural capital. So we're very excited about this initiative.
Kylie Ramper, the CEO of the Queensland Investment Corporation, and a guest with that report. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
ABC News with Glenn Lauder. The United States says it will present concrete ideas for stemming the growing conflict between Israel and Hezbollah at the UN General Assembly this week, following the latest deadly wave of fighting. Here's the BBC's Hugo Bashaga.
The Israeli airstrikes, which hit areas in the south, east and north of the country, brought the deadliest day in Lebanon since at least 2006, the last time Israel and Hezbollah fought a war. Hezbollah, the militia and political movement supported by Iran, has been severely damaged but remains a powerful force. It hasn't yet deployed its more sophisticated weapons, including precision-guided missiles capable of hitting deep inside Israel. The group has remained defiant, saying its attacks will continue until there is a ceasefire in Gaza. Israel has indicated that its campaign is just beginning, an offensive that could include a limited ground invasion to push fighters away from the border.
The Federal Treasurer is defending his government's economic record as the Reserve Bank announces interest rates will again remain on hold. The RBA says the cash rate will remain at 4.35% for at least another 6 weeks, with inflation remaining too high. Jim Chalmers says his policies have helped control inflation to this point.
When the board next meets, it will be a year since interest rates went up. Interest rates haven't gone up for the best part of the year, and this reflects the progress that we've made when it comes to getting inflation down. When we came to office, inflation was 6.1%. It's now half of its peak a couple of years ago.
A former Army officer cadet has broken down as a jury in the ACT Supreme Court found him guilty of two counts of rape and one of assault.